Your Majesties, Your Royal Highness, Professor Schiebinger, distinguished guests, it is my pleasure to welcome you at this special location for this very special event. The location is the former City Hall of Amsterdam, nowadays the Royal Palace. And we are the guests of His Majesty the King, Her Majesty the Queen, and Her Royal Highness Princess Beatrix. They have opened this palace to the public as a place of debate and culture, exhibitions, and of course, symposia such as ours. So let me take this opportunity to thank you on behalf of all of us for your hospitality tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Ineke Sluiter. I'm a member of the Palace Committee, and I will be your chairperson this afternoon and moderate the discussion later on. And after the main lecture, I will say a bit more about the structure of this event. But first, it is my privilege to introduce our guest of honor and our speaker, Professor Londa Schiebinger. I'm looking at that screen, and I would like you to notice that time is a relative thing. I'm going to remove this. Here we go. Londa Schiebinger is the John L. Hines Professor of the History of Science at Stanford University. And she is an acclaimed authority in the field of gender and science. I think that this palatial environment may not be quite a routine setting even for you to present your work. However, I would like all of us to remember that Professor Schiebinger has previously addressed the United Nations Expert Group meeting on gender, science, and technology, as well as the European Parliament. Professor Schiebinger is the mastermind behind the research agenda Gendered Innovations in Science, Medicine, Engineering, and Environment, on which she has written many books. Her list of distinctions is a very long one, and it features honorary doctorates and the election to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, among many other things. Perhaps the most powerful aspect of her research agenda is that it does not regard gender as a category exclusively of interest to scholars from the social sciences and the humanities. On the contrary, the program addresses specifically, as the title clearly states, science, medicine, engineering, environment, and as a result, the company here gathered is a very diverse one, as you may have already discovered or will discover a bit later on. It is really a rare speaker who can bring together academic researchers, philosophers, medical doctors, policymakers, engineers, captains of industry, innovation specialists, creative designers, and a handful of classicists like myself. But you have achieved precisely that. This is the group you have brought together. We are extremely excited, Professor Schiebinger, that you agreed to speak here tonight. And without more ado, I invite you to take the floor.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here in Amsterdam and to be in this beautiful location. So this evening we will explore gendered innovations. And let me figure out how this works. Just a second. Nope. Let's go the other way. Okay. So we're going to explore gendered innovations. Gendered innovations was produced through a large international collaboration involving the European Commission, the U.S. National Science Foundation, and Stanford University. We networked researchers from across Europe and Canada and the United States, and now we're expanding into South Korea and very slowly into Japan. So last year, we also expanded into Silicon Valley. Stanford is only about 20 minutes from Google, for instance. But there can be a divide between academia and industry. And we started a series of tech roundtables in Silicon Valley for industry leaders such as Google, Facebook, and the like. So innovation is about integrating sex and gender analysis into the design of research. The operative question is, how can we harness the creative power of sex and gender analysis for discovery? Does considering gender add a valuable dimension to research? Does it take research in new directions? So first, a bit of background. Governments and universities in the United States and Western Europe have taken three strategic approaches to gender equality over the past several decades. The first, I like to call Fix the Numbers of Women, focuses on increasing the number of women participating in science and engineering. The second, Fix the Institutions, promotes gender equality in careers through structural change in research organizations. And the third, Fix the Knowledge, or Gendered Innovation, stimulates excellence in science and technology by integrating sex and gender analysis into research. So my talk today focuses exclusively on this third strategic approach, fixing the knowledge. It's the newest area and the most important for science and engineering and innovation. And this is what Gendered Innovations is all about. Before moving on, I'd like to acknowledge some of my wonderful Dutch colleagues, and now I'm scanning to see where you are. In particular, I'd like to thank, there she is, Professor Ineke Klinge, who has been the co-director of this project from the very beginning. The European Commission came to me to start this project. It's the empirical basis for Horizon 2020, and they insisted that I have a European collaborator, and Ineke has been the perfect partner over the years. And I also should see Simone Boortendijk. I've known her for years and never can say the name right. But anyway, Simone is a force for precision in socially responsible science, both here and now in the UK. So let's dive in. Doing research wrong costs lives and money. For example, 10 drugs were recently withdrawn from the US market because of life-threatening health effects. And 8 of those pose greater threats for women. Not only did these drugs cost billions of dollars to develop, but when they fail, they cause death and human suffering. We simply can't afford to get the research wrong. But doing research right can save lives and money. And here is one example we have. I would like to work with economists to make more metrics like this. We need some for engineering. But anyway, here's the one that we have that I know about. An analysis of the U.S. Women's Health Initiative hormone trial, a large government-funded trial done in the 1990s, found that for every dollar invested in the research, $140 were saved in healthcare savings. And the study also saved lives. There were 76,000 fewer cases of cardiovascular disease. There were fewer breast cancers and more quality-adjusted life years. The downside was, of course, that there were more osteoporotic fractures. So it's crucially important to get the research right. And this is what the Gendered Innovation tries to help with. We develop state-of-the-art methods of sex and gender analysis and then provide case studies or concrete examples of how gender analysis leads to discovery and innovation. And this evening, I'd like to share some of these examples with you. But first, I want to just make sure we're all on the same page. So I have for you this lovely illustration done by Vera Rigetz-Grosik out of Berlin. She's a powerhouse for gender medicine here in Europe, in Germany. And we want to understand the interaction of sex and gender in individual, in society, in people. So sex, of course, is the genes and sex hormones that develop through your lifetime, and gender are any of the social influences. Here, Vera emphasized nutrition and lifestyle, but it could be education, it could be ethnicity, it could be socioeconomic background, any of the forces that mold us, and these interact through the lifetime to form the adult. And it can, so I should mention that I've just been in Germany, and the Germans have decided that there can be a third category on the birth certificate, male and female. So most humans are male or female, but perhaps 1 to 2% are intersexed. And this is the category that the Germans have. There are 8 nations that allow a third sex. So we don't know the exact percentage because doctors don't record this in the hospital, so we don't know. And then gender really can be any part of the gender continuum, right? It can be any kind of gender identity, gender norms that are adopted in a society and culture. So let me turn to our first example of gendered innovations, how this will be how sex analysis can lead to something new, how it leads to excellence in research. And the first example comes from Cells and Tissues, looking specifically at stem cell therapy. And now, being totally American, I have to use the computer more. Now, how do we get, where is my, this is supposed to go to the website. We had this all set up this afternoon. Oh, wait. No, I have a couple more slides. Let me get, sorry. Okay. All right. Let's go back to why the 10 drugs failed, why they were withdrawn from the market. There are many reasons why drugs fail and fail more often for women. One reason is that most research is done on males, whether it's humans, animals, or cells and tissues. So this study was done in 2011 by some of our colleagues at Berkeley, and it shows the sex of the animal used in research, and the blue indicates here, the blue indicates the males are used more often, the red indicates the females, and you see that females are used only more often in reproduction and immunology. But what I'm interested in here is the gray area on the other side, and that's where the sex of the animal is not recorded. This is research money wasted. You might as well throw it out the window. A similar study was done at Mayo Clinic on cells and tissues. Sorry, what happened? Oh, I'm sorry, this thing. Okay, here we go. A similar study was done on cells and tissues, also in 2011, and here you see only gray area. The sex of the cell is almost never recorded, and again, this is research money wasted. If you don't know the sex of the cell, you can't do a proper analysis. So now I want to go to the website, and is this going to happen now? To stem cell research. So why might the sex of the cell be relevant? Research shows that there are sex differences in the therapeutic capacity of stem cells. And I can show you here. I like to go live to the website in case people want to use this resource. It's something that it's here. It's a public resource and can be used. So if we go to stem cells and we can see... What I want to look at here is the difference between the female and the male stem cell. This is cells taken from muscle tissue. And this indicates that the female cells are more regenerative or active than the male cells. Yet very few researchers consider the sex of the cell, which can lead to failed research. An international team in Norway and Australia were doing some work with stem cells in mice. And they correctly used male and female mice in the experiment, but they used all female stem cells. It was an unconscious and arbitrary decision. And it means that in the discovery phase of research, they didn't say anything unique to the male stem cell, nor did they detect any important differences in function between male and female cells. The result of not considering the sex of the stem cell was that the male mice died. Their male mice were dying, and they didn't know why. It was research money wasted. They had to put the project on the shelf. They didn't know how to move forward. They thought maybe a postdoc made a mistake. You know, when in doubt, blame the postdoc. But eventually, through a gendered innovation workshop in Norway, the team realized that they should also consider the sex of the stem cell, and they found that sex matching worked the best in this case, that male to male and female to female worked the best. But of course, you have to do all the research. You have to look at all the possibilities before you can make any assumptions. But then, of course, it's never that easy. We can't just look at sex differences. We have a method here. I'm not going to demonstrate the methods, but we have a method here that we use all the time, which is factors intersecting with sex and gender. So for humans, that would be age. It would be ethnicity. It would be all of the things that make us in this room different from each other. And for cells, it's also important. You have to look at hormonal difference, immunological differences, and environmental differences. So let me just interject here that sex matching is also important for organ transplant. Now, I hope that none of you need a new heart, but if you do, you want to look at the research to see, well, should I have a male heart or should I have a female heart? It turns out for hearts and for kidneys, sex matching is the best thing. Lungs don't follow that pattern. So that's the sex. That's the science of the sex involved. But now there's a gender issue with this. And that is in the US, and I assume it's also true of Western Europe, women donate more organs. So even if the surgeon knows the best science, there's a problem of not having enough organs. So this takes me to heart disease. I'd like to go to another one of our case studies here, heart disease in women, which was the very first case study that we did. Heart disease in women offers one of the most developed examples of gendered innovation. It's amazing what we've learned over the past 20 years, thanks to many of the people who are in this audience. And as you know, heart disease is a major killer of women. Nonetheless, it has been defined primarily as a male disease, and evidence-based clinical standards have been created based on male pathophysiology and outcomes. And as a result, women are often mis- and underdiagnosed. So an important innovation here is understanding sex differences in the pathophysiology underlying heart disease. So if you get to the emergency room, you've had a heart attack, and you get to the emergency room, the gold standard test you'll be given is the coronary angiogram. And it's very good at identifying the male pattern of disease. So this is the typical male pattern of disease with this pinching off of the artery, but women have a different pattern of heart disease, and that's the general narrowing of this artery, and the technology is blind to this disease. It was developed to see this, but it can't see this. So many women who have finally gotten to the emergency room then are sent home, oh dear, you're fine, you know, but then they may in fact suffer a large heart attack thereafter. So it has been very important that we identify women's patterns of disease, women's symptoms. I think that this is very advanced now. So I want to move then on to gender here. We know the sex difference in heart disease, but now let's move on to gender. And this is extremely new work. The question here is, can we capture gender invariables that can be developed quantitatively in research studies? And this isn't on our website because this is completely new. Now, I'm having trouble finding. It's supposed to go back and forth automatically. So our inspiration here, I'm going to report on to you on a study that was done in Canada, because that was our inspiration for this study. So We know about sex and heart disease, but can we capture social attitudes and behaviors which, in fact, can cause disease, and can we see gender differences there? This is what we'd like to do. So our inspiration came from a study in Canada. To do this study is about acute coronary syndrome which is in people age 55 and younger. And this Canadian study asks which patients will get sick again. So they've already had this problem with the acute coronary syndrome. And then the doctor wants to know who's going to get well, but who's going to become ill again in a year or so. How do I help that person? So to do the study, the Canadian team reduced sex to a variable, which is straightforward. That's easy to do. They found no difference between men and women. So they could have stopped their study there. But the PIs also reduced gender to a variable, and I find this work very interesting. I want to come back again to this slide to remind you that if we only look at sex in heart disease, we only have half the story. So we also need to look at social attitudes and behaviors. So what did the Canadian study do? They started with 17 variables in their study. So this is to measure gender, social attitudes and behaviors that tend to be different between men and women. And they found 7 that were significant and developed a gender-related score from this. So these variables I find very interesting. One is household primary earner. It is a stress, so this is a traditionally masculine role, right? The men have, for a long time, been responsible for bringing in the household income. This can be a stressor. You're responsible for everyone. Personal income, I find this interesting, the number of hours per week spent doing housework, that can certainly be a stressor. And this one, the status of the primary person responsible for doing housework. So even if I pay someone to do my housework, I'm still the one responsible. My husband has a problem, he comes to me, not the house cleaners. So they have captured, I think, a very interesting variable here. They have the level of stress at home, and then something called the BIM sex role inventory masculinity score and the femininity score. Of course, as good scientists, they controlled for sex and age, something called the GRACE score, previous heart attacks, and also things like smoking, obesity, and hypertension. So what were the results? The results are very interesting. They found, again, no sex difference, but they found that gender matters. Patients here in this study received a gender-related score of between 1 and 100, and they found that patients with a higher femininity score, whether or not they were a man or a woman, were the ones who tended to become ill again. So very important. So I see this as innovative methodology. However, there are 2 factors here that are no longer valid. These BIM sex inventory, I can't even say the phrase, right? It's so bizarre. So because many funding agencies now are asking for gender in health research, people are taking whatever is on the shelf and sticking that into their study. So these wonderful people in Canada use this BIM sex role inventory masculinity score and femininity score, and it's no longer valid. Ironically, it was developed at Stanford University in 1974. Who were we in 1974? We were incredibly white, we were incredibly male, and we were incredibly athletic. Okay, we're still athletic. We get a lot of Olympic medals, right? But it's not valid for talking about gender today. So in our Stanford study, we've actually teamed up with the people in Canada. They're very interesting colleagues, and we have our colleagues here in Europe as well, and we have some in South Korea. I'm not sure that these things will go from Western Europe to South Korea, but we can see. And we're doing something called a study, Gender Variables in Health Research, and I'm not going to say very much about this because we're not finished yet. We've been at this for 2 years. It's really difficult. Our innovative moves are to move beyond binary notions of masculinity and femininity. We would like to get rid of these terms altogether. I see them as boxes in society that we constantly stuff people into. I would like to get rid of these terms. And then we try to capture three dimensions of gender, gender norms, identity, and relations. And I wanted to say a couple of words about those. I don't know how to get back to, this was working this afternoon. I'm going to go back and forth. Maybe you want to stay up here. So now I need the website. Okay. Oh, I just click it twice. Okay. All right. So I wanted to say something about gender norms, identity, and relations. Here we go. Okay. So it's loading. So gender norms, it's important to look at these three dimensions of gender. So gender norms are these, they're the forces of society that press in on you. They're the unspoken rules in society, the kind of policing, silent policing we have of roles for men and women in society. And those come from the workplace, from family culture, from institutions, from state and federal law, national culture, global culture. And the second type of gender we want to talk about is gender identity. This is the one you're familiar with, how people identify themselves. And here's where the individual then can push back on the culture and make a process of cultural change. And the third type of gender we want people to be aware of and think about is gender relations. So this is where individuals of different identities, you know, battle against each other or interact with each other. It's the relationship between individuals of different gender identities. So there's much more I could say about medicine, but I'm now going to move from medicine to technology. Technology is an important force, powerful force, shaping our lives. And my next example comes from machine learning. And I'm going to speak specifically about natural language processing and focus on machine translation. So, that's a lot of words. I'll go to our case study on machine translation. And I start here with a little story. So some years ago, I was in Madrid and interviewed by a number of newspapers, Spanish newspapers. I don't happen to read Spanish, so when I got home, I wanted to know what they said about me, and I zoomed it through Google Translate. And I was shocked that I was referred to repeatedly as he. Londa Schiebinger, he said, he wrote, and sometimes it thought. Google Translate has a masculine default. Now, how can such a cool company as Google make such a fundamental error? Google Translate defaults to the masculine pronoun because he said appears much more often on the web than she said. And here you have to use another Google tool. You can't get through a minute of your day without a Google product. This is called Ngram. And it gives you a lot. You can do all kinds of cool stuff with Ngram. But here it just shows you, what I want to show you, is that the ratio of he said to she said was 4-1 through this period, peaking in 1968, and then dropped quickly to 2000, to the 2000s, to 2-1. So today it's about 2-1. So the machine chooses he said because it gets a higher score. Like my Stanford students, it's interested in the score. So now I ask you, what else happened in this period between 1968 and 2000? What are the what's happening in the broader society? The women's movement? Voting rights, well, that happened over here. This is voting rights, period. What happened here, We had the women's movement. We had, what? Oh, washing machines. That actually, washing machines happens here. Birth control pills also. So it's a very large, this is when government started investing money to increase the number of women in science and engineering. A huge process of cultural change. And with one algorithm, Google wiped out 40 years of cultural revolution, and they didn't mean to. It was completely unconscious gender bias. So we said, hey, Google. We called him up. A couple of years ago, the Gendered Innovations Project held a workshop, and we invited researchers from Google and also from Stanford University, and they listened for about 20 minutes, and they got it, and they said, we can fix that. So fixing is great, but constantly retrofitting for women is not the best road forward. I had to ask myself, how is it that these Google engineers, many of whom are educated at Stanford, made such a simple mistake? What are we at Stanford doing wrong? Well, for one thing, we don't teach anything about gender in engineering courses. Sure, you can come on over to history, you can take all my lovely courses on gender, or to the sociologists or the psychologists, but not in engineering. We are not where they live. So this is what we're trying to do now, is to integrate a little bit into each of the core courses wherever it's relevant, wherever it fits. So again, some products can be fixed, but what if Apple, Google, and other companies start product development research by incorporating gender analysis? What innovative new technologies, software, and systems could be conceived? So the point I want to make is a serious one, and it is that this unconscious gender bias from the past is actually amplified into the future. You can see if the machine is talking about a woman and adding he says, it's going to increase that gender bias in the database. So when trained on historical data, as Google Translate is, the system inherits bias, including gender bias. And it turns out that even though Google wanted to fix the problem, they were unable to. It's sometimes harder to fix something once you've developed the basic platform. So it's very important that when we start the research, we get the research right. So Google Translate, like any of our technologies, our devices, our programs, shape human attitudes, behaviors, and culture. In other words, past bias is perpetuated into the future even when governments, universities, and companies themselves have implemented policies to foster equality. So the big question is, how are we humans going to intervene in these automated processes to create the society we want? And I want to say that since this is now a hot topic in machine learning, since we did this case study, the computer scientists have taken this up, and we now have many more like examples. So I'm not picking on Google, but you know, Google is so important with all the stuff we do. So Google search, men are 5 times more likely than women to be offered ads for high-paying executive jobs. In the United States, that would be jobs over $200,000, and the machine understands that women make less than men. So they're just trying to get the information to the people who should have it. But you see, this is automated. Nobody made that decision. It's automated. That's the weird part. So word embedding is a really interesting thing here. So word embedding factual associations found that European American names are more often associated with pleasant words, and African American names are associated with unpleasant words. And here's an interesting one in image search. So, you know, you can search a word and then you get all the images. I love image search. You can get the images associated. So if you put in nurse and search nurse, it returns to you mostly women's pictures, right? It misses the 10% of men in the United States who are nurses. So this also happens with CEO. If you put in CEO, it returns to you images of men and misses the small percentage of women who are in fact CEOs in the United States. So there are many solutions that are emerging, and solutions for these kinds of problems require really interdisciplinary teams. I was at a conference at Harvard. It was really just a workshop last year, and it was an interdisciplinary team of computer scientists, lawyers, political scientists, historians, gender experts. It really takes all these people to come up with the right solutions. So we are having a workshop on this in March at Stanford, and we want to identify exactly where in machine learning this bias resides, whether it's in the input, the data, if it's in the output, the predictive models, or in the algorithms. We want to map solutions. Gendered innovation is solution-driven, so we want to map all the solutions. And we want to discuss who should be involved in the decision-making to fix these problems. Should it be the computer scientists themselves? This means they have to have a lot of background in history and sociology and philosophy and ethics. Should it be teams of ethicists, or should it be government oversight committees? So now I'd like to shift a little bit and talk about robots. Okay, so the robots are surely coming. We know the robots are coming. And I wonder how they will be gendered. So let's go to talk about this. I want to go to our case study on assistive technology. And this can be for the elderly, for the autistic, but we did a case study for assistive technology with the elderly. So we know that the world population will age dramatically by 2050. It will be a problem for European countries, for Asian countries, and this case study explores markets for assistive technology for the elderly and looks at the value added of considering both sex and gender when designing these technologies. So it's very important when we think about assistive technologies to think about the sex-related physical needs that differ between men and women as they age, and also the gender-related social needs, and to incorporate both of these in the assistive technology. So gender issues become important as assistive technology becomes more personalized. For example, a number of robots are being developed. I'll show you a few of these that are being developed. One of these is Cody, not a very attractive character, developed by Georgia Tech. And this is to aid in bathing elderly people. Now, bathing involves a very intimate relationship between the machine and a person. So we really need to get the gender of this machine right. Another assistive, here's another one of these assistive robots. This is Herb. Okay, so have they gendered Herb? You see the bow tie? So, you know, roboticists are looking at what's the smallest clue I have to give to gender the whole thing, right? So now you have two clues. It's called Herb, which is an English male name, and it has a bow tie. So Herb is the home exploring robot butler. Also, it's from Carnegie Mellon. And Herb can fetch household items for you. He can fetch you a cup of tea. He can remind you to take your medicine. And he can clean up the kitchen. Now, if there's a robot that can clean up the kitchen, I'm ordering it immediately. That would be great. This is another one. This is Myra, who is a nursing robot. And it looks to me like they've solved the gender problem with an interchangeable head. You know, because we will personalize. If you can personalize, then you can order your robot and you can say what you would like, right? You can just personalize it. Like the Siri voice, we have personalized it, but you can choose from a couple of those. And then it's interesting that in Japan, they've stepped out completely out of the human realm into this big teddy bear. So the Japanese, this is a one of the big problems with elderly people is lifting and carrying. I watched my elderly father in a nursing home to do bathing, just for a bath. It takes two humans to pull him out of a chair. He has to be placed on a sling and taken over to the bathing, to the bathtub. And so the Japanese are trying to help by creating these machines that can lift and carry people. And there won't be enough human assistance, right? As the baby, as my generation, the baby boomers age, there won't be enough, shall we say, women to take care of everyone. So we can have machines take their place. Now, where does gender fit into all of this? Importantly, as these robots enter our lives, we humans will gender them. Whether they give us a clue or not, we tend to gender things. So a study of machine voices, synthetic voices, machine-generated voices, showed that human listeners assigned a gender to the voice even when the designers had tried to create a completely gender-neutral voice. So we know that a lot of these assistive voices like Siri, Apple's Siri, these are all female voices. And I used to play this party game where I asked Siri why she was a woman. And one of her responses was, I was not assigned a gender, implying that it's not Apple's fault that I am assigning her a gender. It's my fault because I am doing that. So as soon as humans interpret a voice as a male voice or a female voice, we tend to apply all of our stereotypes, our human stereotypes, to the machine. So here we need to come back to this method that I mentioned before, the one where you look at factors intersecting with sex and gender, because we have to ask which women and which men. When developing assistive technology, not all women are alike and not all men are alike. If we just look around the room, we can see that there are plenty of differences in age and other things. So, for example, Siri can't understand. One of my friends is French, and she has a beautiful French accent, but Siri can't understand that at all. And then I have a Jamaican friend, and he can't get a voice on the machine to match his own, right? In English, we can choose Australian, British, and U.S. English, not India. They've kind of missed out a whole continent there, but certainly not Jamaica, which would be just a small number of users. So we have to consider many factors. I think we need to include lots of people. So we are going to have a workshop at Stanford in January on gender and robotics. And we have four questions we want to ask. The first one is about gendering robots. Why do people feel the need to attribute gender to robots? Can't they just be their own thing? Some people have suggested that there be special pronouns for robots, so you don't call it a he or a she, but some other kind of way to refer to it. Then in this gendering, is gender domain specific? Do you want a woman's voice for dating advice and a man's voice for math tutoring? Are we going to make those kinds of things? Our second question is about gender characteristics. What genders a robot? Is it appearance? Is it voice? Is it mannerism, movement, or demeanor? And the roboticists, as I said before, are now trying to reduce that to just one thing, and then you would know what the gender is. Our third question is about setting research priorities. Why can't robots clean up the kitchen? And what do people want robots to do in the house? They're going to be in your home. Is that creepy? So we know that house and caring work are gendered issues. Despite recent gains, women globally perform the vast majority of domestic labor. So I think this, but we don't have robots that do that yet, right? To clean up the kitchen. So we're interested in that. And then our fourth question is about gender and emotional intelligence. What is appropriate social touch between robots and humans in relation to the gender of the person vis-a-vis whatever you might think about the gender of the robot? So research shows that humans often harass robots. You know, for instance, the Siri voice, Apple is collecting all the data of what we say to Siri. And Siri is quite often harassed, but she is also told that I love you. She is also proposed marriage. So, you know, so what is this relationship between humans and robots? And then in researching this question of social touch, I learned so much about how we humans touch each other. There are very different rules about women. Women are allowed to hold a hug longer. Did you know that? Women are allowed to touch more around different parts of the body than men. So there are all these rules that we humans have, and we learn them without even thinking about it. And so the robots are going to be taught something about that. What will they be taught, and who will it help? Okay, I think I'm going to come, I'll just do one last little example because I want to get out of Europe and the United States and go to sub-Saharan Africa very quickly and do an environmental case study looking at water infrastructure. So here we are. So this story, this case study, has to do with water infrastructure. Nearly 1 billion people worldwide lack reliable access to water. In sub-Saharan Africa, women and girls spend some 40 billion hours a year carrying water. So here the gendered innovation is actually tapping into this local knowledge. It's called participatory research. It's a collaboration between civil engineers who would be going into countries to develop water infrastructure and local knowledges. Because carrying water is women's work, many women have detailed knowledge of soils and the water they yield, knowledge that is vital to civil engineers when placing wells and water taps. And here we see a woman in Ghana who is mapping well sites. And here, with this kind of community participation, you can vastly improve the water services. And this then becomes a win-win situation in these African countries. When girls are not carrying water, they tend to go to school, and they can thus hopefully break out of the cycle of poverty. So now I want to come to my conclusion and look just quickly at policy. I could give you many more examples. We have 26 case studies on our website, and we know that designing sex and gender analysis into research is one crucially important component of contributing to world-class science and technology. So let me go to policy, because it's very important to science to have the policy supports in place. And I'm looking first at granting agencies. So how many of you, by show of hands, how many of you evaluate grants at granting agencies? I say, oh, wow. Okay, we hit that one. So granting agencies can ask applicants to explain how sex and gender analysis is relevant in their proposed research. I was just at the German Research Foundation, Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, and they're about to integrate this requirement into their proposals. So every proposal would be asked, is sex and gender an important part of your research or not? If it's not relevant, just say it's not relevant and why not. So here, it's very interesting. We have then graded, I guess you would say, granting agencies on fixing the numbers. Do they have policies for that? Fixing the institutions and fixing the knowledge. And for the knowledge, we've then included the policies that people have developed so that if your agency is developing new policy, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, but you can see what others are doing. So the European Commission, I would say, is really the global leader in policies for gender innovation. In December 2013, the European Commission launched Horizon 2020 and encouraged the PIs to seeking funding to integrate sex and gender into their design of research. And in 2013, the EC identified 137 fields of science and technology where they would expect sex and gender analysis to be relevant. These include computer hardware and architecture, nanotechnology, oceanography, geoscience, organic chemistry, space medicine, biodiversity ecology, and so on and so forth. And of course, the social sciences and the humanities, health and medicine. And I'd like to announce that we will be adding to our website the Dutch Organization for Health Research, because they have recently asked for sex and gender analysis for public-funded research. This is very important. I think it's really pioneering. Now, the second thing that we talk about here, give policies for, are for peer-reviewed journals. So you want sex and gender analysis at the beginning of the process when designing the research, then you want to reinforce it at the end of the process when publishing research. So editorial boards of peer-reviewed journals can require sophisticated sex and gender analysis when seeking papers for publication. Last December, we published in The Lancet. You'll see that these are mostly biomedical journals. I'm going to come to work with engineering journals in the next year. I'm on sabbatical, so they should watch out because I have time to do this. So I'm hoping that we can add some of those. Last December, we published 5 Easy Steps for Biomedical Journals in The Lancet, and the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors also adopted our guidelines, so I think medicine is really well set up now. Then another, I don't have a portal yet for curriculum, but another reinforcing part of this whole of encouraging sex and gender, encouraging excellence in research, is to get it into the curriculum, university curriculum. There's only one medical school that I'm aware of that really does this well, and that's in Berlin, Charité, where Vera, the chart I showed, where she works. So I know even at Stanford, we have not yet included all of the important information about sex and gender differences in our medical curriculum. So I'm obviously working on that. And then fourthly, industry. It's very important for industry to think about these things. Products and systems that incorporate the smartest aspects of gender can open new markets. Products that meet the needs of complex and diverse user groups enhance global competitiveness and sustainability. So there's much to be done. Researchers need to learn sophisticated methods of sex and gender analysis. Universities need to incorporate these methods into the curriculum, and corporations need to integrate these insights into product design. But eyes have been opened, and we cannot return to a world that ignores gendered innovations. It's this kind of innovation that makes the world tick. And as I hope I've begun to show, gendered innovation sparks creativity by offering new perspectives, posing new questions, and opening new areas to research. Can we afford to ignore such opportunities? Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, Londa. Thank you, Professor Schiebinger, for really an extraordinary lecture. I think it's a very promising start to this whole event. Ladies and gentlemen, I may now invite you to join us for some appetizers, then followed by dinner. And after dinner, you will be invited back into this room for the discussion period. It would be really wonderful if you could use dinner time, not just to catch up with old friends and make some new acquaintances, but also to think and talk about questions that you'd like to be raised here. At every table, there will be a table host, mostly members of the Palace Committee, who will collect these questions and somehow get them to me just before dessert, I guess. I hope you will all be kind to my eyes and write clearly, including your name, and I will then try to make sure that as many topics as possible can be covered during the discussion. One important last issue is this. Our discussions will take place under the so-called Chatham House rule. This means that we are all free to use the information that we are sharing here, but no one can be quoted individually by name. So this will provide the maximum freedom for everyone here to speak his or her mind. So, I cannot be quoted on this. But it is time for a drink. Thank you.